The Underground Railroad History Project of the Capital Region's 14th Annual Public History Conference is taking place this weekend, April 17th through the 19th. This year's conference is entitled Breaking Free, Civil War, Emancipation, and Beyond. It will feature among its events a Saturday morning keynote, Underground Railroad to the Fight Against Neoliberal Racism, The Long Struggle for Black Liberation. It will be presented by Henry Lewis Taylor, a professor in the Department of Urban and Regional Planning at the University at Buffalo and the founding director of the Center for Urban Studies. Dr. Taylor's research focuses on a historical and contemporary analysis of distressed urban neighborhoods, social isolation, and race and class issues among people of color, especially African Americans and Latinos. And it's a great pleasure to welcome Dr. Henry Lewis Taylor, Jr. to the roundtable this morning. Thank you very much for being with us. I appreciate it.
It's a pleasure.
Obviously, there are a lot of very important words in the title of the keynote that you'll be giving on Saturday morning. Give us a sense of the message that you want to deliver.
The message, the core of that message, is that the struggle of African Americans for freedom has been a long and tortuous trail that has moved through multiple epochs in time, and it is a journey that continues. And what I want to do in the brief period of time that I have is to construct a framework for understanding why that long struggle has persisted, why African Americans, after some 400 years, still do not have freedom. And what role the Underground Railroads and its various iterations have played in that struggle over time.
Do you think that when you look at this as a whole of this long struggle, and indeed a long struggle, but were there always opportunities and times where it could have ended and didn't have to be a struggle anymore?
Yes, there have been critical moments in the nation's history, where choices were made not to allow blacks to move forward and acquire that level of freedom. But there were minutes where choices had to be made. For example, slavery lasted for 246 years. It wasn't a short thing, and as abominable and as inhumane that system was, it lasted for 246 years. And it lasted that length of time because of the enormity of wealth that flowed from slave labor. I mean, the wealth is incalculable. So when that system finally ran against the processes of moving the nation toward a more industrialized region, and the war was fought to end slavery, at that moment of time, the U.S. government had a choice. Give the confiscated land, give those resources to the black slaves, the people who had toiled that land for 246 years. Give that land to them. Provide them with the resources to become independent farmers. Now, to really understand this, the Confederate War was a war in which over 700,000 people lost their lives. That's more people than all of the wars that this nation had combined. The allies of the United States in that war were blacks. More than 40,000 died on the fields of battle fighting for the Union. Give them the land. Let them be the kings of the cotton industry. Provide them with the technical resources and the money to make that happen. The country chose not to do that. Instead, they turned the land over to the former members of the Confederacy.
Mm.
They gave the former members of the Confederacy, the traitors, control over the governmental apparatus. They created a situation in which after 246 years, the creation of untold wealth, blacks became a landless, penniless peasantry that had no choice but to become sharecroppers and tenant farmers for the former leaders of the Confederacy. Those individuals who embarked on a war that cost over 700,000 lives, and they were rewarded by being allowed to return to power. So blacks got locked at that critical moment into a system of sharecropping and debt peonage in which they were perpetually tied to the land. So that was a moment. That was a critical moment where we had a choice, and we chose not to do that.
The title of the talk that you will be giving on Saturday, as I mentioned, is Underground Railroad to the Fight Against Neoliberal Racism. Define for us neoliberal racism and how it is present today.
Neoliberal racism is a racism that becomes deeply embedded into your economic system and the way in which that economic system operates and the culture in which it breeds. I can give a good example by just utilizing Ferguson, which is on everybody's mind these days, about the dimensions in that location and place. One example of neoliberal racism is that large numbers of African Americans, regardless of whatever their levels of credit ratings are, were forced into or ended up taking subprime loans. The proportions of them doing subprime loans is significantly different than other races and groups. And as a consequence, when the 2007-2008 housing crisis hit, the black community was devastated. In Ferguson, who had a home ownership rate of 46%, which is slightly above the national average and higher than any of the surrounding municipalities in St. Louis County, ended up in a situation where 58% of black homeowners ended up with underwater mortgages. And an underwater mortgage is when the value of your home is less than what you owe the banks. So your equity, or the wealth that is created through equity, not only disappears, but it places you in debt. So you have these neighborhoods with large numbers of mortgages that are underwater. In black communities, unlike white communities, are communities with large numbers of renters. Well, most of these renters are low-income renters. And the way the economic system operates and works, housing is increasingly made a public venture. So these rental units for low-income residents are owned by private investors. And in places like Ferguson, an increasing number of institutional investors and hedge fund investors seize controls of foreclosed properties and flip them over to renters. Well, in a private investor, in order for them to make money, the rental calculus has to work. And by that I mean to say they have to charge rents that exceed the cost of maintenance, operations, upgrades, and property taxes. When the rents don't exceed that, they pull back on maintenance and upkeep until they're able to hit the bottom line. So low-income folks who are already paying 40 and 50 and in some instances 60% of their income on housing, they're not going to ever be able to generate levels of income that would allow them to do that. So the result is the maintenance and upkeep on their properties is reduced. That, in turn, impacts the homeowners that make their houses even worse. So that is one example. Another example of neoliberal racism is what we call municipal inequality. And by municipal inequality, I'm saying when higher income whites move out of the cities, move out of suburban areas inhabited by blacks, and move into predominantly white municipalities, suburban municipalities, you see an unequal distribution of wealth that is multiplied because that wealth is captured in these smaller municipalities. And so if you create an income ring around places like Albany or Buffalo, you'll see areas where blacks are concentrated in one place, and you'll see that these are also the poorer, more underdeveloped areas with the greatest needs, both in terms of the physical development of their communities and the needs for the different types of organizations and institutions to deal with their problems and issues. But the wealth is captured somewhere else. So what we have in the settlement patterns is a system of unequal distribution of wealth and resources. And a person to get rid of their responsibilities to the development of the entire region, they simply have to change addresses. And that's why across the nation, whether it's in the suburbs, whether it's in a central city neighborhood, the moment blacks and Latinos begin to move into those neighborhoods, threatening that exclusivity, the whites leave and they move to a neighborhood where they can protect their resources and they don't have to fairly participate in the redevelopment of the entire region. Those are just a couple of examples of what I mean by neoliberal racism.
Dr. Henry Louis Taylor Jr. is our guest. He will be presenting the Saturday morning keynote at the Underground Railroad History Project of the Capital Region's 14th Annual Public History Conference. Again, the name of his keynote, Underground Railroad to the Fight Against Neoliberal Racism, the Long Struggle for Black Liberation. In mentioning Ferguson and in the examples of neoliberal racism that you just gave, how direct then a correlation can be made to have a young African-American, a teenager, in the path of a bullet fired by a white police officer?
That's a great example. The big question is, who created, how did this road get created? A one-way street going both directions. That is, a single street that's one lane, but it's designed so traffic comes both ways. And that's my metaphor for Darren Wilson and Michael Brown. Take Ferguson. Ferguson is in the North County in St. Louis. And that North County has become almost predominantly black because large numbers of whites have moved out. In fact, between 1970 and 2010, the Ferguson white population dropped by some 60-70%. And so they're a minority. But because of the unequal distribution of wealth, and you see in the western suburbs in St. Louis, enormous resources and wealth, all of those little suburban communities in the North County are suffering. Those little municipalities, they don't have enough money to pay for their goods and services. So one of the ways, not just Ferguson, mind you, but all of the little municipalities, even the all-black municipalities, have resorted to aggressive policing in order to generate resources. Ferguson was more extreme than others, and the magnitude of tickets that they give out are incredible. I mean, I think in 2014, in a city of around 21,000, they gave out some 33,000 citations, mostly to low-income blacks, and about a quarter of their budget is related on this income source. So they're what I call vampire suburbs, and they're vampire suburbs because the unequal distribution of wealth in St. Louis County creates rich places and struggling poor places. That's what it does. So this guy is doing what they do, aggressively police. The guy's walking out in the middle of the street, but he's not that far away from where he lives. And if you look at the physical environment in Ferguson, they basically got no sidewalks. Right. I mean, people walk out in the street. I mean, there are no sidewalks. And so it was that physical environment that constructed a one-way street with traffic going in the two different directions. One person driving a Volkswagen, Michael Brown, and the other one a big pickup truck, Darren Wilson, speeding in opposite direction. And that's not the first time these inequities have created that. They talk a lot about that, but they don't talk about a few years ago, back in 2008, with what happened with Cookie Thornton. In a small town just a stone's throw from Ferguson. Have you heard of Cookie Thornton?
I have not.
Cookie Thornton was a black guy that lived in a suburban, unincorporated community adjacent to the little suburban community of Kirkwood, an all-white community, much more affluent than the little black clusters. As a way of trying to displace blacks, they annexed the area, then utilizing urban renewal legislation, began to seize control and demolish the land owned by blacks. Cookie Thornton begged them to leave his land alone. They wouldn't. They took his land. And in anger and in frustration and bitterness, he went to the Kirkwood City Hall, attacked a policeman, took his gun, shot him, then went inside of the courtroom, city council, shot the mayor in the face and killed about three or four other people. That's an example of neoliberal racism, where you utilize city building tools, zoning, creating big lot suburban communities, zoning to keep out certain types of housing structures, urban renewal to get rid of and use eminent domain to take lands that don't belong to you, but you don't like these people. That happened a stone's throw. But a lot of that stuff is resulting from the levels of municipal inequality and the legalization and legitimization of the formation of these little small enclaves where people can retreat, build municipalities that capture their resources so that they do not have to equitably share them with the rest of the region. And these are elements of the structural elements of racism that are not as spectacular and as easily viewed and seen as the more obvious forms of racism. But you have this individualized racism and the structural racism. They work hand in glove. So the decision of people to move out of areas because they don't want to live with blacks, or other decisions that flow from those individual activities, are all integrated into the structural ways in which the entire system works and operates in a manner that underdevelops black communities.
We only have about 2 minutes left, but I'm curious as to your level of optimism when it comes to the evaporation of those elements that you just described and ultimately the long struggle, so that we can see not just pockets of Black liberation, but a universality to Black liberation.
When I take the long view and taking a look across 400 years is a long view, the great optimistic thing I find is one, that we continue to win victories. Slavery was defeated. Sharecropping and debt peonage was defeated. State-sponsored discrimination and racism was defeated. Overt, hostile, in-your-face racism was forced to hide in the forest and the woods. That was a tremendous victory. So we can win. We continue to win victories. We're marching toward the light, not toward the darkness. The second thing, whenever Blacks and whites have united, and whenever Blacks and whites and other groups have united, those were the moments when we made the greatest progress. When we come to realize that it's not that the Black struggle is a struggle for the American people. I mean, if you understand that it was the Black struggle that shadowed the barriers that kept immigrants out of this country with the passage of the 1965 Immigration Act, it was the Black struggle that gave birth to women's rights movement, the gay liberation movement, the Native American movement, and the movements of lots of other people to change the way that they live and carry out their lives based upon the realities that they came to understand by witnessing and participating and being a part of the struggle for the movement. So we are moving toward the light. That doesn't mean that we're at the light. But the history of our people, the history of humanity says that we will get there one day. We don't need to be shrouded in illusions. Like, we've become a country that prefers the comforting lie rather than the painful truth. And so we embrace this idea and notion that we were in some kind of post-racial heaven that was made signified by the election of Barack Obama as president. Ferguson brought us back to reality, the painful truth, that we have become the most oppressive nation in the world in terms of jailing people. Nobody puts more people in jail than the United States. That's a painful reality that we have to face. And if we are able to continue to face those realities, and if we're able to unite across the racial divide and the class divide to build a better and a just America, we'll get to turn on that light one day. And I believe that we will.
Dr. Henry Louis Taylor Jr. will present the Saturday morning keynote at the Underground Railroad History Project of the Capital Region's 14th Annual Public History Conference. For more information, you just go to undergroundrailroadhistory.org, undergroundrailroadhistory.org. Dr. Henry Louis Taylor, I thank you very much for spending time with us this morning. You're very inspiring, and I appreciate you sharing your message with us this morning.
Thank you very much, and you take care, my friend.
A great pleasure. Thank you. Again, you can find out more information by going to undergroundrailroadhistory.org. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.